Our next speaker is Lieutenant Commander Luke Dixon from the Royal Australian Navy Future Submarine Program. The title of his presentation is Human Factors in Hostile Environments, Projecting 102 Years of Experience in Australian Submarines to Long-Haul Space Missions.
Good morning. My name's Luke Dixon. I'm a space engineer by education, a marine engineer by occupation, and a serving submariner. I'm currently the Systems Engineering Manager for the Future Submarine Program. I've been a passionate advocate for the exploration of space for as long as I can remember, and I think it was when I first saw Return of the Jedi at the drive-in as a child that my interest began. Establishing permanent colonies on the Moon and Mars are the first steps towards colonising our solar system, but physics being physics, we can't yet avoid the need for long-duration transits. Astronauts will need to survive and thrive on the journey there and back. Very few people come close to the kinds of physical and psychological hardships that astronauts face, but one group are submariners. Submariners are confined within a pressure vessel for months at a time, very far from home, in a very hazardous environment. The Royal Australian Navy has over a century of experience in operating submarines. Some consider submarines to be the spaceships of the ocean, and apart from the differences in speed and the view and the microgravity and Klingons, the analogy holds pretty well. So today I'm going to talk to you about Australian submarines and their crews, what life's like on board, some of the specialised technology that we use, how we stay focused and healthy, and what can go wrong. I'll cover some of the research going on and talk about the science-based approach that we're using to design the future submarine. Then I'll offer some suggestions about how to keep astronauts alive and healthy on long-haul space missions. So submarines are some of the most complex pieces of machinery created by humans. Now, the Royal Navy's Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Arthur Wilson, said in 1901 that submarines are underhanded, unfair, and damned un-English. Treat all submarines as pirates in wartime and hang all of the crews. In response, the submarine service adopted the Jolly Roger as its flag. Now, the Royal Australian Navy acquired two submarines prior to World War I. They were small, cramped, dark, filthy, and reeked of diesel fuel. They had no provision for personal hygiene, atrocious food, and horrific living conditions. AE-1 was lost off Rabaul in 1914, and AE-2 became the first Allied submarine to penetrate the Dardanelles as the Anzacs stormed ashore in Gallipoli. She was damaged and scuttled 5 days later. After World War I, the submarine service was briefly re-established two more times in 1919 and 1927, but we had no submarines in World War II. There was a British submarine flotilla based in Sydney from 1949 to 1969, and its withdrawal prompted the re-establishment of the Australian Submarine Service in 1967. And this occurred with the acquisition of six Oberon-class submarines. And during the Cold War, they conducted many covert patrols throughout Southeast Asia. They're very quiet, but designed to transit to and from their areas of operation on the surface and then submerge to conduct their missions. The living conditions on board were just as cramped and filthy as early submarines. And they literally reeked of diesel fuel, and the living conditions were Spartan at best. So we acquired the Collins class from 93 onwards. Now, they're true submarines. They're designed to dive upon sailing and conduct their entire mission while submerged, sometimes across vast open ocean distances. After a somewhat troubled gestation and some reliability issues in the previous decade, the Collins class now enjoys the world's best availability and reliability. It's one of the most effective and lethal war machines in the ocean. In 2009, our government announced plans to begin the process to replace the Collins class, and that is the Future Submarine Program. That's where I'm from. So submariners hail from every state and every region of Australia. We come from a wide variety of backgrounds with different ambitions and dreams, people of every race, colour, creed and gender. Australia is one of only eight navies in the world that includes women in submarines, and we were only the fourth nation in the world to do so in 1998. We practice what's called integrated messing, whereby men and women share the same sleeping compartments. Collins' boat has a crew of 60, and the captain's the only person on board who gets his own cabin, about the size of a medium-sized broom cupboard. The rest of the crew share 5 and 6 berth cabins, which are smaller. Everyone's got their own bunk, however, and it has a curtain. The showers and toilets have lockable doors. That is the entire extent of privacy on board a Collins-class submarine. There are 2 watches on board, whereby half the crew is on watch at any one time. They're 6 hours long, and they run from 1 to 7, 7 to 1, 24 hours a day, every day. When you're on watch, you're on watch. But when you're off watch, that's the time to eat, sleep, recreate, use ablutions, maintain personal hygiene, and do any other work that you need to do. Fatigue is a constant factor on a submarine, and the 6-on-6-off routine is brutal, particularly for those personnel on watch from 1 a.m. to 7 a.m. They're awake precisely when their circadian rhythms are telling them that they're idiots and should be going to sleep. So 12 additional personnel sleep on removable beds in the torpedo room beneath suspended torpedoes. It requires a significant psychological effort to muscle your way past the fact that you're sleeping beneath a torpedo filled with several hundred kilos of explosive. Trust me. But once you do, they're the biggest and best beds on the submarine. The officers are control room watch keepers, keeping what's known as the look through the periscope. They control the ship's system, supervise the helm, the sonar and combat system operators. They navigate and constantly conduct tactical appreciation. The crew keeps watch in the control room and in the machinery spaces at the aft end of the submarine. We have three departments on board. They're the Executive, Marine Engineering and Weapons Electrical Engineering departments, headed by the XO, the MEO and the WEO respectively. The XO is responsible for the Action Information Organisation, navigation, sonar, communications, electronic warfare, galley services, medical, ceremonial and whole ship coordination. The MEO is responsible for maintenance and upkeep of the platform system, the entire platform, including propulsion, power generation and distribution, air, lights, water, hydraulics, ship structure and domestic services. The WEO is responsible for sensors, combat systems and weapons, including sonar, radar, communications, electronic warfare and navigation equipment. So in keeping with the space theme, the CO is Captain Picard, the XO is Riker, the MEO is Geordie LaForge and the WEO is equal parts Data and Worf. So like spacecraft, submarines must carry most of their consumables but can extract some resources from their environment. A submarine can extract air and water for its own use but carries all of its fuel and food. Spacecraft can harness electrical energy from sunlight but must carry everything else. Non-nuclear submarines or conventional submarines use massive battery banks to store energy and diesel generators to recharge them. But we don't need to surface to do that. We raise a snorkel to draw in fresh air. Primary sensor is the sonar and it's like a giant directional microphone. The speed of sound in water changes depending upon the temperature, salinity and pressure, so sound paths actually curve, and we exploit this phenomenon to hide from the enemy. This is called tactical oceanography and is a vital part of maintaining acoustic stealth. So is maintaining noise hygiene. This means that we're all quiet, we don't bang doors, minimise noisy activities and don't drop tools in the bilge. A noisy submarine is a dead submarine. So the periscope allows us to see above the water, which is vital for maintaining visual safety. Ships can't usually see submarines, so we have to spot them first and stay out of their way. The sonars and periscope and combat system allow us to maintain situational awareness at all times and at any depth. Buoyancy is a constant concern. When a submarine dives, the seawater pressure increases, squeezing the hull and decreasing its displacement, resulting in slightly negative buoyancy. To maintain neutral buoyancy, we have to pump a little bit of water out. And the opposite is true when coming shallow. So weight comp is summarised as down and out, up and in. A conventional submarine also consumes fuel over time, and our fuel tanks, are seawater compensated. So the overall weight changes, as well as the weight distribution throughout the submarine. So the longitudinal balance or trim must be controlled. And above all, the watertight integrity of the hull must be maintained. An uncontrolled ingress of water into the people tank is anything but good. The submarine is brightly lit throughout, and sleeping spaces have red lighting. Periscope watch keepers need to be able to preserve their night vision, so the control room dims the lights at twilight and switches them off at night. There are four meals every day: breakfast, lunch, dinner, and midnighters. Now, they straddle the watch handover times and allow the crew to eat before and after watch. We have pizza nights on Sundays, and on really long deployments, we even get freshly baked bread. There are some drawbacks, however. After about a week, there's no more fresh fruit and vegetables, milk and bread is thawed from frozen stocks, and the potatoes begin to become self-aware. Sometimes the food situation can go very, very wrong, such as when the only vegetables left are parsnips. I have no adequate words to begin to communicate my loathing for the parsnip. The reality of service on board a submarine is something that's completely alien to anybody who hasn't experienced it. At sea, the boat rapidly becomes your entire world, and your shipmates are the only people in the universe. There's no email, no internet, no phones, no social media, and thankfully, no Kardashians. Information about home and the outside world is strictly limited to only mission essential information getting in or out. Once a week, a submariner can receive a 20-word family gram from home. The CO sees all the personal messages first and must decide what is best for the crew and the mission. It is rare, but sometimes a submariner finds out that a family member has died weeks after the fact. There are lots of things that can go wrong on a submarine. A flood can happen on a ship, but when a submarine is several hundred metres below the surface, the water pressure is much, much higher. Even a small hole sees an incredible amount of water enter in a very short period of time. In 2003, one of our Collins-class submarines suffered a breach at maximum depth. 20 tonnes of water entered the hull in less than 7 seconds, and she barely made it back to the surface. If there's a flood, an emergency ballast blow will hopefully get the submarine back to the surface. If not, the submarine could become disabled on the seabed. Who here remembers the Kursk incident? If the depth is shallow enough, the crew can try to escape using special suits or wait to be rescued. But if the submarine's far enough away, that might not happen in time. And if you think that's scary, think about this. Less than 5% of the oceans in the world are shallow enough for submarine rescue. If the submarine sinks in deep water, it will rapidly exceed its crush depth and suffer catastrophic structural failure, crushing like a beer can. There are many other potential problems which, because they're occurring inside a sealed tube underwater, make dealing with them infinitely harder. Fires, toxic gases, hydraulic bursts, giant squid attacks, battery explosions, fuel spills, high-pressure air bursts, main battery earths, and even the odd engine run-on, where the diesel engines refuse to shut down, consume all the air on board, and asphyxiate the crew. This occurred to a Chinese submarine in 2003. All 70 on board died. From time to time, but not often, a submariner may suffer a complete mental breakdown and try to open one of the hatches to get out. This is called anxious man procedure. That person is sedated, restrained, and removed from the submarine the first opportunity. However, at times, that may take weeks. This may all sound frightening, and it is, but submarine crews train extensively for every possible contingency. This reduces the chance of surprises and conditions us to remain focused on the tasks at hand, regardless of the danger. When we're very far from home and in a hostile environment, with no chance of sympathetic assistance, we each trust our shipmates to do their jobs right, and vice versa. If everyone does it right, we all get to see our families again. We have a saying, everyone returns to the surface or no one does. The isolation and harsh environment result in an extraordinary level of esprit de corps, the brotherhood that binds together people who share hardship. It helps us to cope. We do everything that we can to foster an elite mentality, because being part of an elite group of people doing a dangerous job far from home requires us to rely on each other, to trust each other to an incredible degree. It enables us to dig deep for our shipmates. Discipline on board a submarine is much more relaxed and informal than the rest of the military, and instead relies upon mutual respect and sheer competence. The process to earn the submarine sea qualification or dolphins is arduous, but every submariner must prove themselves by earning it. Being able to function effectively in hazardous environments requires that you accept your own mortality and face those dangers head on. And the best way to do that is to tell sea stories and make jokes, lots of jokes. The gallows humour on board submarines is renowned, and very few things are sacred. But around the dinner table, politics, sex and religion are taboo topics. We embrace the pirate identity that first identified the submarine surface. The slang term for civilian clothing is actually pirate rig. And every time we enter harbour after a successful patrol, we always fly the Jolly Roger flag. Off-watch personnel have a full range of movies, computer games and board games to amuse them if they wish. An entire crew can get hooked on a good TV series simultaneously and start using phrasing and terminology from the same show. Now, submarine mission is a great analogy for a long-haul space mission. First, the submarine is undocked or rolled out, the stacks rolled out. It's a complex procedure and the culmination of many, many months and hundreds of thousands of man-hours of maintenance. The crew undertakes individual and collective training on simulators and training aids to bring their skills up to the level required to operate the ship safely. The crew trains to handle the boat, deal with any emergencies, and to operate their combat systems. Careful consideration must be taken of the route there and back, what must be achieved and what supplies are required to complete the mission. The safe return of the crew is always the highest priority. The mission could last for many months and take place several thousand nautical miles from home base. The transit to the mission area takes a long time, so maintenance of the crew's health and well-being becomes paramount. When in the mission area, everyone focuses on the task at hand and the danger becomes the greatest. The transit home is just as long as the transit there, but now the rising risk of complacency on the homeward stretch must be actively managed to keep the crew focused on their jobs and not drifting. And finally, the return to home port and some much-needed rest and recuperation. In a submarine, if we're lucky, we'll get a couple of port visits in for some time off during the deployment. On a mission to Mars, however, it won't be possible to just pop over to Phobos for a few cartons of beer and some lamb chops. So the Future Submarine Program is taking a science-based approach to human systems integration. It's the first time this has been attempted in the maritime field in Australia, but this is the first time we're designing and building a submarine from scratch. We're doing things differently from what we have in the past to try and generate an advantage over our potential adversaries by not just having the best equipped platform in the region, but having the best trained and highest performing people. Submarines and spaceships may be shiny, complicated and expensive, but they only exist to enable the carbon-based life forms inside to do what they need to do. Our research efforts are looking at mapping cognitive performance and information flows within the submarine using ergonomics, process automation and information fusion to evolve command and control systems of the future. Human endurance and fatigue is a major concern and have significant impacts on cognitive performance, as we've seen. Research on circadian entrainment and artificial cueing for triggering sleep and alertness is underway. Mapping of more efficient work systems with emphasis on high-fidelity simulation and training will ensure that we can match the best training to the most prepared minds. Habitability research is looking at maximising the quality of life at sea, as well as reshaping our strategic focus from submarines to submarine crews, with the aim of developing sustainable long-term crewing structures. Anthropometry is helping to shape the human systems needs of the future. As recently as last year, the Navy conducted high-fidelity full-body scans of over 1,500 sailors and officers. This library of data and the statistical analyses performed on it has fed directly back into the design of systems, layouts, human-machine interfaces and more. Humans aren't designed to be squeezed into complex machinery spaces and be expected to perform their tasks well. And humans need to be taken into consideration of every design from the very beginning. So, if I may, I'd like to offer a few points to consider. Astronauts need to be kept in the best physical condition. This means maximising sleep quantity and quality. Manipulating sensory triggers to match circadian rhythms to rest periods. Fatigue is insidious, and without the opportunity for a port visit, astronauts cannot afford to be fatigued. Exercise and nutritional supplements will be vital in space. Without gravity or centripetal force, the trip will take a heavy toll. They need to be healthy when they arrive, and they have to survive the trip back. Food has to be varied, nutritious and plentiful. It's vital for overall health, but is a massive factor in maintaining morale. There's no opportunity to stock up on fresh supplies, so the planning is vital. Each crew member needs their own personal space, be it a cabin or a bunk with a curtain. The ability to shut oneself away from everyone, to have a little privacy, is vital for maintaining one's sanity in confined environments. Downtime has to be just that, and recreation and entertainment systems will also be important. The astronauts need to be given maximum opportunity for recreation within the limits of the mission. If they're happy, they're invested. If they're invested, they're focused. And if they're focused, the mission stands the best chance of succeeding. Medical issues and the fact of total isolation from full medical and surgical facilities must be considered. A trained surgeon on the crew could probably deal with most expected issues, but serious illness and even death is a possibility. The psychological impact from the death of a crew member could be severe. As far as possible, the dignity of the deceased must be preserved without compromising the mission, but the health of the remaining crew must take absolute priority. Communications from home will be essential for keeping the crew's spirits up, but the risk lies in knowing that nothing can be done to affect the situation back home. That's why the crew shouldn't have unrestricted access to communications. The death of a loved one or some sort of bad incident will have a massive, psychologically detrimental effect on the astronaut, potentially becoming a danger to themselves and the other astronauts. There needs to be discretion, and the commander should have the responsibility for passing on bad news, or not. And finally, crew cohesion. It will not always be tight. Arguments will happen. Humans are emotional creatures with needs other than eat, work, sleep, repeat. So designing systems for physical utility only is a mistake. They need to maintain a workable social structure. It's crucial. And the military is a ruthlessly meritocratic hierarchy. Each of us knows exactly what our place is in the pecking order and the tasks that we need to carry out. The shared sense of danger and patriotic purpose helps us to bind together. But we can surface and get the hell off the submarine for some fresh air if we need to. You can't do that in space. Astronauts are exceptional people, and they'll be confined together far longer than any submarine crew. The challenges they face will be huge, but not insurmountable. Every effort must be expended to keep them healthy, happy, and sane. So long-haul space missions will require humans to thrive in environments for long periods of time. The Australian Submarine Service has been doing that for just over a century. We stand ready to help. Thank you.